From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Dodger pitcher Julio Urias is back with the team. An investigation continues into whether he shoved his girlfriend, knocking her down in the parking garage of the Beverly Center. Eyewitnesses reportedly claimed that's what happened. The couple denied their verbal fight turned physical. We'll debate whether public performers should work while investigations are open. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Coming up, Uber's offering a premium service, including silent mode. You're now able to request in advance that your driver not talk to you. The social implications of that option, I want to hear from both drivers and riders. But first, Dodger pitcher Julio Urias, a young star of the team, expected to be back in Tampa today as the Dodgers open a series with the Rays. Urias has been on paid administrative leave for the past week. An LAPD investigation continues into whether a verbal altercation between Urias and his girlfriend turned physical. The dispute occurred Monday of last week in the Beverly Center's parking garage. The LA Times say sources told them eyewitnesses claim Urias pushed his girlfriend, knocking her down. The couple reportedly denies that their dispute turned physical. Major League Baseball could have extended Urias' leave for another week, but reinstated him. My question for you is, what is the best approach to use in a case like this, where a police investigation is continuing? You have conflicting accounts of what happened with the incident. And what are the best ways to treat particularly public figures who presumably are held to a higher standard than members of the general public? With us is Los Angeles Times sports columnist Dylan Hernandez. He was the beat writer for the Dodgers for the LA Times for a number of years. Dylan, good to have you with us again.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So there have been other cases, I know, where Major League Baseball did multiple week-long paid administrative leaves while investigations were continuing. What have you learned about, in this case, why Major League Baseball reinstated Urias to the Dodgers?
Well, I think that, they were getting nowhere in terms of, getting more evidence. Part of obviously the big thing would have been to get this videotape. And for one reason or another, they have not been able to do that. And I think that under these circumstances, they determined that it would have been a challenge to get the player and the player's union to agree to extend the administrative leave, because the leave can only be extended under, with the consent of the player.
Okay. So if Urias wants to come back after a week, the investigation is still open. Major League Baseball can't go any further without a videotape. Then it sounds like they pretty much were compelled to reinstate him.
Correct. Yes. And, because if they hadn't, and baseball has one of the most powerful unions in sports, or the most powerful union in sports, actually, they would have filed a grievance, Major League Baseball probably would have lost that. So, there have been cases like this where, say Addison Russell of the Chicago Cubs, who just came back, I believe last month, there were, a friend of Russell's ex-wife put something on social media about how she had, how Russell had abused his wife. Major League Baseball looked into that, received no cooperation, and they just kind of left the case kind of open for a while. And then at some point, Russell's ex-wife, I guess, had to get this off her chest, wrote a very detailed blog post about what happened, then agreed to talk to the commissioner's office, and they kind of went from there. So I'm guessing we're kind of looking at the same situation here where this isn't by any means settled. Obviously, if the videotape were to pop up on TMZ or something, which things are kind of prone to do these days, baseball could, wind up, you know, punishing him then.
Or if charges were filed, presumably misdemeanor, I suppose it could be a felony. But in a case like this, I would guess it's you're looking at misdemeanor domestic abuse. Then presumably they could suspend him for however long they deemed was sufficient for that. Although maybe would they wait to see if there's a conviction?
Yeah, they might, you know, and I think that that's kind of right. They do have, it does seem like that the commissioner's office has a pretty decent amount of leeway here. You know, there have been, you know, I'm trying to, you know, looking back at all the list of suspensions that they've given, you know, under this policy. You know, I don't think any of these athletes have actually been convicted or pleaded guilty to anything. Right. So, you know, even in cases where, you know, police decided like not to press charges, you know, there have been cases where Major League Baseball says, OK, well, you know what? Yeah, OK, maybe it doesn't show that you necessarily struck your wife. But, you know, we think that your behavior on this night was inappropriate and therefore we'll suspend you 15 games. So, yeah, the commissioner's office has a pretty decent amount of a leeway, it seems, to be able to dole out punishments in these circumstances.
My memory may be faulty, but I seem to recall years ago in professional sports, when there would be an allegation against an athlete, that the athlete would typically continue playing unless or until the case was actually adjudicated. The player would not be sidelined during a period of investigation at all, as I recall. But Dylan, do you know anything about that? Or is it your sense that in recent years there's been a shift?
Oh, there's definitely been a shift, you know, and I think that a lot of it has to do with this kind of social media climate that we're in where, you know, images are very readily available. And I think really the game changer in professional sports was the Ray Rice incident, right? Where I think initially, he was a running back with the Baltimore Ravens. And I believe initially he got like a 2-game suspension or something. Then the video came out, right? And the video showed him and his wife in the elevator, and he just cold cocks her, knocks her out with a single punch. I mean, it was, you know, it looked like a professional fighter knocking somebody out. And I think that just kind of horrified everybody. And I think professional sports have been very kind of proactive in trying to do something about this, right? They don't want to look, I think, you know, and you kind of hate to be cynical and say that it's a PR thing, but a lot of this is PR. And I do think that they're, you know, they don't want to look like they're allowing this type of behavior to flourish, you know, so they will try to kind of come down as hard. And I think, you know, like in a case like this, I think, right, with Arias, I think Major League Baseball's huge fear is, what if this videotape comes out at some point? You know, we can't look like we did nothing here if this videotape does come out and it shows something that we don't like.
Well, and I think it's fair to say that folks in your business have played a part in this because, you know, there's a lot of criticism by sports writers if someone has allegations against them and a team either, you know, considers trading for the player or not suspending the player. You know, I think there's just a lot of condemnation. There's kind of a piling on of these teams if they have any business whatsoever with someone accused.
Yeah, you know, and I think that that's kind of where we also have to be careful, though, right? I mean, I think, you know, especially let's take Arias' case. I mean, you know, in my experience, he seems to be a really nice kid. Everybody that I've talked to him says, you know, this is really kind of out of character. Obviously, he and his girlfriend are denying it. They were in the Beverly Center. You know, I could see, right, which is kind of a, you know, higher income type area, so to speak, right? And here you have, a Mexican pitcher with his Mexican-American girlfriend. And, you know, I could see, and I'm not saying that this is what happened, but I could totally see a scenario where, you know, in that environment, people saw two brown people screaming at each other and called the police. You know, and if that's the case, obviously, that's extremely unfortunate, too. So, yeah, there is this kind of balance, I think, that we have to play of not, in cases where, again, there isn't evidence or the evidence isn't clear, to not play judge and jury in stuff like this and maybe kind of hold back a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the case of Aroldis Chapman, the hard-throwing reliever for the Yankees, you know, when he was available to be signed. And I remember in the L.A. Times, there were all these writings about how terrible morally it would be for the Dodgers to sign Chapman. And I don't think there had been a specific disposition of his case at the time of that. But it sort of put the Dodgers in a position where they couldn't sign him after that kind of media push.
Yeah, well, you know, and again, there was at least like a police report, you know, and again, you're getting into gray areas here, right? Of, you know, what's what, you know, and I think, you know, there was at least like a fairly detailed account in this police report, you know, and I believe it was Yahoo Sports that originally reported it. And it kind of went into detail about, you know, Chapman shooting off his gun and grabbing his, you know, wife or girlfriend by the neck. So there was at least like an account, there was kind of a narrative there that, you know, that was, you know, at least, you know, if it got out, obviously, which it did, that would have kind of scared the fans, you know, unlike a case here where there's really kind of nothing to go on, right?
You know, unless the video, which police are looking at, shows that there was physical contact. L.A. Times sports columnist Dylan Hernandez with us. He also, for a number of years, was the Dodgers beat reporter. I'd like to hear from you what you think is the best way to deal with situations like this. I'm not just talking about Dodger pitcher Julio Urias, but what is the best way for dealing with a case that's under investigation where there's been no determination as to whether charges are filed, there's been no trial if charges are filed, should a performer, not just an athlete, but a performer, someone in the public eye, should that individual be sidelined until an investigation is completed? Or is that unfair to a person accused? Is it better to let the justice system or the investigation internally of the entity like Major League Baseball or, you know, whatever, whoever the employer is, do their investigation while the person continues to perform to determine whether any sort of crime or conduct that's considered to be detrimental to the sport is investigated. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also with us is HR consultant Steve Albrecht. He focuses on workplace violence, and he's a former domestic violence investigator with the San Diego Police Department. Steve, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Larry. I think one of the pieces we haven't talked about is how common it is for these victims to either not cooperate with the police or recant. If your boyfriend is a famous baseball player or an entertainer, there's a monetary issue. Sometimes they're concerned about, you know, cooperating with the police. And also, my concern also as looking at these cases overall is sometimes this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's the one that was reported as opposed to the ones that may have happened that did not get reported.
Yeah. But by the same token, you can't assume it happened simply because his girlfriend might have motivation to downplay or deny the incident.
Yeah. The reason that there's value for Major League Baseball to suspend him administratively is at least to say we take the subject seriously. There are consequences for your behavior. If it was not proven from a legal standpoint, at least from an administrative standpoint, we have some set of a business ethics kind of a solution to this issue.
So it's sort of a symbolic action that doesn't isn't necessarily predicated on what he did or didn't do. It's just saying we take it seriously. He's going to be off the field for a week and then we'll figure out what to do.
I think that's true. And if you look at like Tariq Hill from the Kansas City Chiefs, as soon as the allegation and the videotape came out about his alleged assault of his girlfriend, I mean, they cut him from the team. So there's substantial consequences even for really good players and star players in all the leagues that engage in these behaviors based on what Mr. Hernandez says about the Ray Rice case as being kind of the standard that we follow now.
Let me share some listener comments. Belinda writes on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, innocent until proven guilty is the expected protection of individuals against the state, not a private group nor public opinion, especially in the current environment of an epidemic of intimate partner violence. That's Belinda writing on the AirTalk page. Rude Torpedo writes, Larry, ever heard of innocent until proven guilty? Even the alleged assaultee disputes the assault. You can join us with your comments about this. How best should an employer of a public figure handle an incident like this? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Steve Albrecht, is there a different standard in your view for an employee of some sort of a company or service where it's not a public figure versus someone like Urias or an entertainer, elected official, someone in the public eye? Is there a different standard? Should there be, in your view?
Well, there shouldn't be a different standard, but there certainly is. If you look at these people that we pay millions of dollars to as entertainers or sports figures, there's certainly an expectation that their organizations want to get them back on the field or off the bench and off of suspension. It's much different than if it happened in a public sector or private sector organization where the economic value of these people is not the same, although the behavior may be exactly the same.
So in a case like that, if it's not a public figure, are you saying the typical thing, if there's an allegation of domestic abuse, the employee would be put on administrative leave until an investigation is conducted? Or would typically in the workplace the person be able to work pending some disposition of the case?
I think it depends on the consequences and the seriousness of it, but administrative leave is a pretty common tactic. Most often they're put on paid administrative leave while the court process or the prosecution process takes place. And one of the things we talk about is the conviction issue may not come for a year down the road, even if there was an incident that was proven. So sometimes the adjudication is much farther than the actual event took place, could be 6 months to a year.
That puts a lot on the employer, though, that they're going to have to continue to pay the accused employee up to a year and not get any services from that individual.
Yeah, I think that's pretty rare that they would keep him on salary for that long on suspension. They usually make some type of decision based on a conversation with the police or the prosecutors about the seriousness of it. And also, we look at the past as a good indicator of the future. Have these things happened before? Is this not the first time we've heard this type of allegation?
Well, so let's say you have, and again, this non-public figure, employee is accused by a spouse of domestic violence, employee denies it, the case is being investigated. Is the employer protected if they let the individual go before the case has been tried based on the accusation of someone else, either an eyewitness or the individual's the alleged victim?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, HR policy in most states is that we have employment at will states, which we can fire somebody for any reason, and it doesn't have to necessarily be, based on that type of situation. If we look at employment at will, there's a suggestion that you have the right to be there as an employee. We have the right to terminate you as an employer. And we usually now follow some type of a process. We want proof. We want some sort of justification for what we do. We don't just fire people randomly. But if we look at these types of situations and we say there's a history, there's a context here, we have threats of violence that have crossed over from home into the workplace, we're concerned about the safety of others. You've seen, Larry, these cases where these spouses or ex-spouses have come back to the workplace and shot and killed their former, girlfriend or boyfriend, and or husband or wife. It's a significant concern, and the employers are playing the balance now between safety for all the employees and the protection rights of the accused employee.
I'd love to hear from you again with Julio Urias, at least for now, back on the field with the Dodgers. Does it change your impression of him? Would you treat him differently at a Dodger home game? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dylan Hernandez, LA Times sports columnist. It seems to me that when Addison Russell came back with the Cubs, that he was actually booed by Cubs fans after he returned from his suspension. I was a little surprised by that because I thought he'd been a popular figure before the suspension.
Yeah, but I think, the domestic violence thing now is, people don't like you know, particularly kindly on that. I guess I'm not too surprised, you know. Also, the fact that I think the way it played out to where, again, you know, the initial allegations kind of came out, and then, you know, months, right, he wasn't obviously, you know, very cooperative, and then, you know, kind of got forced into doing so, you know, when his ex-wife finally decided to speak out. So, you know, I think that that's, yeah, nowadays, to me, it's a little bit different. You know, this is a little bit different than even, say, like a steroid suspension where, you know, you could use a moral relevancy argument that, well, everybody's doing steroids, that type of stuff, or we think everybody is, you know. This is, I think, like a pretty hard no-no for most people if the evidence is clear.
So when the Dodgers return to Dodger Stadium, if Urias is still playing for them at that point, where we are now with the investigation, Dylan, based on the many Dodger games at Dodger Stadium you've attended, you have any guess as to how the fans will respond?
I think he's going to be cheered, actually, you know, because, again, there's at this point, we haven't seen anything yet, you know, and again, the kind of going back to that Ray Rice thing, it's always the image, right? It's, you know, you think about kind of the athletes that have become reviled after these things have happened. I mean, it's always a case where there's a photograph involved or a videotape involved. Here, there's really kind of nothing. And, you know, the facts themselves are kind of up for dispute. And this is a player who's pretty popular, you know, and I think, I mean, let's be honest, Los Angeles is a city that cheered on Kobe Bryant. So I can't imagine that they wouldn't cheer on Julio Urias, you know, in a case where the facts are much, much muddier, you know, less clear than they were even with Bryant's.
All right, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dylan Hernandez was for many years the L.A. Times Dodgers beat writer. He's sports columnist now for the Times. And Steve Albrecht, HR consultant who focuses on workplace violence. He's a former domestic violence investigator with the San Diego Police Department. We thank them both for being with us. And, of course, with Julio Urias, the Dodger pitcher, back in uniform, expected to be available for tonight's Dodgers game against the Rays in St. Petersburg, Florida. We'll continue to cover the story. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about a new option for Uber Black passengers. That coming up on Air Talk. Now shut up and drive. Uber Black is the service that is provided for riders who want something a little more luxurious for more money. Uber Black has an option that it's recently rolled out that allows riders to ask for a particular temperature within the car, to have a larger window where the driver will wait for the passenger to arrive. And it also has silent mode. That's right. You can request that your driver doesn't speak to you while you're having your ride in an Uber Black vehicle. Joining us to talk about this option is Josh Constein, editor-at-large for TechCrunch. Josh, good to have you with us again.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So, what have you learned about how Uber decided to offer this as an option?
So this has been one of the most requested features of all of Uber for years now. And I've had tons of people tell me they want this. And I actually wrote an article a few months ago saying that this would be something that would be great for customer service and great for especially women who don't always feel comfortable when they're being berated by questions by their Uber driver and they don't want a conflict by telling them they don't want to talk. And so Uber spent a few months researching and talking with its premium drivers. And it found out that there was actually overwhelming support because these drivers do want to give the best level of service to their riders.
But these premium drivers, aren't they? These are commercially licensed drivers, right? These are not your typical part-timers that drive for the regular UberX service. The Uber Black, they're pro drivers, aren't they?
Exactly. These are professionals who are driving nicer vehicles and are being paid more per ride to offer that extra level of service. And that means everything from making sure somebody gets to the exact place they want to go on time, that they wait for them for extra time, but also that they're more polite in the car because they're trained drivers. And this isn't something that they're doing as a side gig.
Well, is the problem, though, with drivers hitting on women passengers or drivers who won't be quiet, is this at all a problem with Uber Black, or is this a problem with UberX, the non-commercially licensed drivers?
This is a problem across all levels of car service, but I've certainly heard more reports of this coming, of this happening in UberX vehicles with less experienced drivers or ones who aren't so committed to the work that they know that they can't afford a single bad review.
And in all the surveys that Uber did about this, why did they find people had a hard time speaking up and telling the driver, I'm exhausted, I'd like quiet, or I'm working, or, why couldn't they just tell the driver they wanted a silent ride?
I think for some people, that's fine. It's easy for them to speak up. But there's a lot of people out there that have social anxiety or just feel nervous having any type of confrontation with somebody who's literally in control of their life. If you get into a disagreement with your driver and he say, oh, I didn't mean to offend you, I was just trying to make small talk, why are you so mad at me? If that's a person who's driving you around in a motor vehicle, can drive you wherever they want, are truly in control of your life, it can be a scary situation. And so some riders have wanted to be able to preempt that by just saying, hey, I don't want to start a conversation at all, so that way I don't have to tell you I don't want to have a conversation.
I'd love to hear from listeners. What do you think about this? Does it make sense to you to be able to pre-select that you want a quiet ride without the driver talking? Do you feel that in some way that limits the human experience of just sharing your wishes verbally with the driver when you get into the car? What do you think? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. I also welcome hearing from drivers, not just passengers of Uber or Lyft vehicles. If you're a driver for either of the ride-hailing services, I'd be interested what you think about this. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Also with us is Jay Crater, who is a full-time Uber and Lyft driver, has more than 24,000 rides during his ride-hailing career. He contributes to the Rideshare Guy blog, and he also has his own ride-sharing site and podcast called Rideshare Dojo. Jay Crater, good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. Good to be with you.
So what do you think about this? Does it make sense to you that riders would need to have a pre-selected silent request as opposed to just asking you for a quiet ride?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I don't like it. As a driver, as a human being, I like to speak. And I don't like anyone telling me, shut up and drive. So, no, I don't like it. It's kind of a slippery slope. So they can tell us, to be quiet. What's next? They're going to tell us that we, have to be a certain weight. Our hair has to be cut a certain way. I mean, part of the skill of being a driver is reading the situation. And it's what gets me tips. So part of the way I earn my revenue is not just from the rides, but also from the tips that I get. And if suddenly I can't have conversations with my passengers, then that's going to impact my revenue.
Do you think this is going to spread to UberX vehicles?
I have no doubt that this is going to spread to UberX. And at that point, I mean, I get it for the premium, the premium ride. If I'm getting paid 2 to 3 times more for a ride, sure, then I can be quiet. But the way things are set up now, I have a very good feeling that this is going to spread to UberX, and there won't be any increase in revenue, and that's going to be the new norm.
I also wonder if it's going to spread to other requests. With UberX, I mentioned the temperature request that the passenger can make. I also wonder about the radio, because You know, sometimes you get into an Uber or Lyft vehicle, the driver's listening, maybe music you don't particularly like. Doesn't bother me because I feel like, well, it's the driver's workplace. If he or she wants to listen to a particular music that I don't like, that's their prerogative. It's not my right as the writer to say I don't like it. But I could see it spreading to something like that. What do you think, Jay?
Yeah, I think so, too. And I'm my passengers in my car, if they don't like the music I'm playing, they will say so. Now, I happen to play classical and light jazz, and I play it at a very low volume. And most of my passengers thank me for the very quiet, peaceful ride. But I could certainly, and I've been in cars where, you know, I've had loud rap, you know, pounding in the background. And I spoke up. I said, hey, can you turn the music down? You know, it's not that difficult to make a request. I have a daughter who's 22, and she takes a lot of Ubers. And she's not been hit on. She's been flirted with a little bit. And I told her, honey, if you get hit on, you give the driver a one rating, and then you contact Uber and Lyft, and you file a complaint, and you get that guy deactivated. So there's a system in place, if people who are upset just speak up, to have that driver deactivated so he's not driving anymore. Obviously, nobody wants our younger women, anyone, to get hit on while they're in their car. But I think we're going too far by instituting this new policy.
Do you get asked, Jay, by passengers, would you mind if we don't talk, or you know, I need to do something or need to close my eyes and rest during the ride? And if you do get that request, are you offended by that or you comply? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, I rarely get that because I've gotten pretty good at reading my passengers. So, you know, I train people how to drive and I say, shut up and drive. Don't talk too much. Passengers really just want a quiet experience. And occasionally a passenger will start asking questions. You know, we get asked a lot of questions. Hey, what do you like better, Uber and Lyft? Can you really make a living at this? You know, questions like that. What's been the longest ride you've taken? What's been the shortest ride you've taken? And those passengers want to talk. They want to engage. They want us to kind of entertain them. But the majority of passengers just would like to sit in the back. A lot of, you know, millennials, they will just look at their phones the whole ride. And that's fine with me. You know, I'm happy to drive them around. So it's pretty unusual that they say, you know, can you shut up? Can you stop talking? Because
you're paying attention as a driver. You're reading them. I appreciate it, Jay Crater. He'll continue with us. Full-time Uber and Lyft driver, more than 24,000 rides. He contributes to the Rideshare Guy blog and has his own Rideshare Dojo site and podcast. Josh Constein of TechCrunch, editor-at-large, also with us. We're talking about Uber Black, the premium Uber service, as one of the options for riders when you book your car, that you can request silent mode, that the driver not speak to you. What do you think about doing that? Does that dehumanize the experience? Is that better than having to ask the driver for a quiet ride or giving cues you'd rather not talk? What do you think? 866-893-KPCC. We have some listener calls we're going to take as we come back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Next hour, we'll talk about a bill in Sacramento which would obligate cities to accept brick-and-mortar cannabis sales, marijuana sold on site, whether they want to allow it or not. We'll talk about the response to that from cities and counties throughout the Golden State. But right now, we're talking about Uber's premium service known as Uber Black, which now allows passengers to pre-select when they're booking their car and driver a silent mode where the driver's instructed not to talk to the passenger. What do you think about that? Is that a nice option to have? Does it make sense to you? Or does it erode the human contact where typically you'd have a passenger who would request a silent ride if the driver doesn't pick up on that cue on her or his own? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Tam in Inglewood. I understand you used to be an Uber driver. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's great. Because a lot of the passengers, frankly, talk too much. I found that I prefer to do food delivery over the Uber driving because of that, because I got tired of having the whole conversation. So I think it's a great thing.
Did you rate the passengers lower if they talk too much in your view, or you just let it go?
I just let it go, but I don't know. It's tiring sometimes, you know, and I found that the passengers want to talk more than the drivers. I just wanted to drive and, you know,
sure,
get them to their destination in a timely manner. But I got a lot of people that just wanted to babble on, and I decided to do food delivery.
Yeah, because they don't talk. They don't engage you in that. Tam, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Tam in Inglewood. Let me go back to Jay Crater, full-time Uber and Lyft driver. So Tam comes into this with you know, very, very different sorts of desires as a driver. How did you handle it if you had a rider who wanted to talk too much? Has that never been your experience?
Yeah, I mean, that's just part of the job. You know, some people do want to talk. And, you know, I've always looked at it like I'm there to be of service, and part of my job is to listen, you know. Most people in life want to talk, and everyone's talking at each other. So when they come into my car, this is a place where they can be heard and share their story and tell me what they want to tell. And those people tip really well, you know, because they had an experience, a human connection with me. So, I mean, I understand what she's saying, but that's just part of the job. You know, for me, that's part of the job, and it's probably great she's doing food delivery now because she doesn't, you know, maybe she's not as socially interested in having these conversations. I do find when passengers talk, I learn stuff. I mean, I'm in San Francisco, and the amount of information I learn about the tech industry and data and artificial intelligence and startups and, you know, people traveling to different parts of the world and their experiences, every day is a wealth of knowledge. So.
Yeah. I was up in Sacramento a few weeks ago and had a terrific Uber driver from the airport to the UC Davis Medical Center is up there because my dad was having surgery. And the driver was great. He was talking to all about what's going on in Sacramento and how the city's changed all the years he's lived there. It gave me wonderful insight as we talked, you know, into what's going on in the city. And that to me is one of the values as a passenger. If I'm not exhausted, if I've had a long flight and I'm exhausted, I may be pretty quiet. But, you know, if my energy level's high, and I always like to learn about the cities and what's going on. And to me, that's kind of an advantage. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Is it Simone in Santa Monica?
Hi.
Hi, Simone. Go right ahead.
I was previously a Lyft driver and Uber driver, and I actually had this idea myself when I was driving one day because I thought that it was hard to know the kind of how to communicate that to passengers, or for passengers to communicate that to me. Like, what are the social cues of someone not wanting to talk while someone else is in a talkative mood? And so I thought that the app should have some sort of indication. And so for me, it's a lot nicer to know.
Do you feel like when you were driving for Lyft, it was difficult for you to read the passengers as to whether they welcomed conversation or wanted quiet?
For me, it wasn't that hard. You know, it is just kind of a part of the job to know, you know, how someone's, or kind of feel out the situation, you know, each ride. But I do have to say I feel like it would take a lot off of me, and it would make me focus a little bit more on the driving aspect of it if I just kind of knew from the get-go that you know, that we won't be talking, or that we will. It'll just be a little bit more like we could use our technology to communicate these things in a bit easier way.
Yeah. Simone, thanks. Appreciate it. Sharing her experience as a former Lyft driver, she welcomes the pre-selection of quiet mode for people booking ride-hailing services. What do you think? Should this go wide for all Uber and Lyft drive, where when you book your pickup, you can choose quiet mode? You like that or not? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dave in Irvine says, it's a good feature. I feel totally comfortable asking drivers to be quiet, but I can see how some people would be intimidated by that. Francis in Glendale says, I drive for Uber and Lyft. My first instinct is to not want to talk, just to drive. Most riders are the ones who initiate the conversation. Seth tweets at AirTalk, I've driven for Lyft and always followed the passenger's lead. If they wanted to talk, I talked. If not, I kept quiet, no charge. Always played soft classical music, usually Bach's lute suites, which almost always elicit a thank you. And I believe it's Efto in Beverly Hills says, I'm an Uber driver. When a rider comes into the car, I have to confirm where they're going. I ask if they have a preferred route. How am I supposed to do that if I can't talk to them? It's ridiculous. Josh Constein of TechCrunch, do you know, are the drivers under this silent mode able to have at least some sort of orientation conversation?
Absolutely. These drivers are still welcome to ask, say hello, to confirm the destination. This is more about once the ride is in the middle of it, just having these endless chit-chat conversations. And I think we just need to remember that this is still a service job. And if somebody doesn't want to have a job which involves either having to be quiet or talk to somebody, then yeah, there's plenty of other roles, even at Uber as an Uber Eats food delivery driver, where you won't have to make those choices or be in that awkward situation. And so I think we really need to remember that if somebody wants to be in this.
I think we just lost Josh. Okay, we'll try and get him back. Once again, love to hear from you if you are a regular user of ride-hailing services or if you drive for one of the two ride-hailing services. What do you think about it's now just in the Uber Black Premium service where you can pre-select quiet mode, silent mode, do you like that? Would you like to see it go wide? Or do you think it's a mistake? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Grace, in the West Adams District, you're on AirTalk.
Hey, Larry, thanks for everything that you do. My comment was just, whenever I take a Lyft more Lyft than Uber, but I kind of step into it with the feeling of this is a person that, yes, it's a service, but they're doing me a favor. They're taking me where I need to go, but we are equals. And so I like to have friendly conversation, even if it's just very light, how you doing, how's the weather been? And then it kind of comes in and out naturally as far as interests and where we're going and where I just came from. And sometimes I'm coming from a flight and I'm exhausted and I kind of lead in with that as, oh, it's been a really, long flight. So you'll have to excuse me if I'm kind of a little quiet. And then it's kind of like, oh, of course, no problem.
Yeah. I like that interaction myself. It sounds like you do too.
Yeah. And I kind of get where Josh is coming from as far as that option with the Uber Black, but I also kind of get this feeling like, it's almost an excuse for people to say, you know what, you're just my driver. I don't want to talk to you. And that's the vibe that I get from it. But I don't know if that's how it comes across to drivers. But
well, and with the Uber Black Premium service, again, because they are commercial drivers, these are, higher end, often larger vehicles. That is a bit more of the traditional professional driver relationship.
Right. And, it's funny, though, because When I was growing up, we literally had a driver who would take us to the airport and, when I was growing up, my family was well off. But we still had a friendly relationship with them where it was, hey, how you doing, the weather, where are you headed today? And so I guess for me personally, even when it's an Uber Black premium service, which I have taken on occasion, I still view the driver as my equal. And so, the friendliness is there. And I can appreciate if it's from a perspective of we're just getting off of an international flight. And we're
sure. Yeah.
Out, or we're about to, we're heading to a business meeting. So we're talking amongst ourselves back here.
Grace, I need to end, but thank you so much. Appreciate it, Grace, in the West Adams District. We'll continue our conversation, taking more listener calls. Really like to hear your perspective about this option for the premium Uber Black service of pre-selecting a silent mode when you order your car and driver. 866-893-KPCC, back in just 60 seconds. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're looking at ride-hailing companies and should they make universally available when you book your ride a quiet mode, requesting that the driver not talk to you beyond just the basic information required to complete the ride. 866-893-KPCC. Kelsey in San Pedro, what do you think about this option?
Hi, I am grateful that they're implementing this. I've had experiences that have run the gamut. I've used either Uber or Lyft with my significant other who is a male, and we've had, you know, pleasant experiences, but then I've had rides when I've been riding as a woman by myself where it's been inappropriate and more than uncomfortable, and I'm not a very confrontational person by nature, so it's hard for me to speak up. I mean, you know, afterwards, obviously, I'll give the driver one star or something like that, but going forward, it's nice to know that I'll have the option to select that I want a quiet ride, so I won't potentially be in a situation that will make me uncomfortable.
So you'd like to see this across the board. It sounds like. Kelsey, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Let's talk with Alan in Burbank. What do you think?
Yeah. Hi, Larry. I've had the reverse experience. Most of the time, it's the drivers talking to me, and they end up telling me their whole life story. And I'm in the car. What can I do? So I have to listen, but it's I'm trying to keep quiet, and there I become their father confessor, so to speak. So.
See, it must be you, Alan. You just have that sort of presentation. They feel they can trust you and open up and want to tell you their life story.
Yeah, this happens in other areas of my life, so it doesn't surprise me.
So would you use the option if you had the button?
Well, I think I might, depending on the situation, yes, because it's just, especially on long trips coming from the airport, which is where this has happened most of the time, then they really have the opportunity to tell their stories.
Think of all the drivers' lives you've helped by listening, Alan. I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I relate to Alan's experience. I've heard so many of those life stories and typically initiated by the drivers. But I'm open to it. I'm cueing that I'm open to that. And I ask follow-up questions and I feed the conversation because I typically am interested in learning about the driver. But I let that start that off. Anisha in Inglewood says, I actually like the silent mode option. I wish they would include it across the board. I don't want to talk to my Uber drivers. I don't want to feel forced to talk, but I also don't want to be rude by telling them I'm not interested. Julie writes on the page, many of us are tweeting, blogging, and in many other ways, encouraging each other to unplug and get back to what's important in life. So what's important? I don't think it's a bad idea to find out who's sitting in the front seat, person who's taking you to the airport or the party, seeing if it's okay for going okay for them. My neighbor on a plane, the woman who's doing my nails, or Lyft driver can make it plain to me if they need space. But if they've got a story to tell with tears or laughs, I'm all ears. That's Julie writing on the AirTalk page. Joaquin in South LA says, talking to strangers is good for your mental health. A little interaction goes a long way. We just talked about that issue, the benefits of talking with people you don't know, last week on the program. Benmont tweets at AirTalk, Lord, can't people just politely tell the driver they'd rather not talk? This kind of elitist bull is very dehumanizing. The one good thing is it might hurry along the revolution. Obviously, for women who want want to avoid being hit on. Very understandable. Ben Mott tweets otherwise. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Ben Mott, by the way, founding member Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Anthony in West Hollywood, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that becoming a feature across the board on both Lyft and Uber, for whom both I drive.
Yeah, so you get tired of passengers talking to you?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's just, for me, it's a matter of, like, you're an Uber expert, I want maximum gratuity. And I don't think it comes from me being a conversationalist. I think it comes from providing the passenger with whatever experience makes them most happy and most comfortable. And, like, you know, a perfect example is women who don't want to be hit on or flirted with. I understand that. And I'd appreciate being told up front that they would prefer no conversation.
Yeah.
And likewise, you know, I've worked in the past on other jobs with people who are hardcore introverts, so, you know, almost borderline spectrum disorder people who really are made uncomfortable by the most casual, superficial kind of conversation with strangers.
Yeah, so you're able to pick up on that and honor that. I appreciate it. Diego in Long Beach, we're real short on time, but I understand you drive for a ride-hailing company. What do you think?
I appreciate and I echo the previous caller's sentiment about how I recognize that I, as a male, can sometimes pick up female passengers who are apprehensive. But a lot of times so I default to being quiet, but a lot of times in order to fill the space, I'm actually playing KPCC on the radio.
We love that.
Yeah, driving in the car is one of the few places where people still listen to the radio. And so sometimes people will comment on that and be like, oh, yes, you're listening to the KPCC. I love it. And that will occasionally spark conversation. But I appreciate this because one time I would have done this for the passenger. I had a really sore throat one time when I was driving, and I didn't want to speak to anybody because it hurt. So I actually turned on the disabled sort of button that is on the Lyft platform that allows the rider to know that the driver is hard of hearing.
So they wouldn't talk to you.
I didn't want to talk to anyone.
But they're all talking to you very loudly when they did talk with you. Diego, I appreciate it and so glad you listened to KPCC as you drive around. I've heard that's quite common. My mother always has a fun time when she's in a ride-hailing car and KPCC is on or AirTalk is on and something that's on is a source of conversation and she can shock the driver saying, I'm Larry's mother. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. My thanks to TechCrunch editor-at-large Josh Constein and Jay Crater, a full-time Uber and Lyft driver, Rideshare Dojo, his site and his podcast. He also contributes to The Rideshare Guy. It's AirTalk on 89.3 KPCC. Very full second hour to come. Good morning, it's AirTalk. I'm Larry Mantle. So much news going on. Glad you could join us to get an update of what's happening in the world. A little bit later this hour, we'll talk about an announcement by Governor Gavin Newsom, in which we're expected to hear more about the state's effort to deal with mental illness and its intersection with homelessness as well. That coming up later this hour. We'll tell you what's in that, whether it's funding or any appointments that have been announced as part of that. But first, we turn our attention to California's Proposition 64, which legalized recreational cannabis. Part of that initiative was that it allowed municipalities and counties to be able to choose not to have brick-and-mortar sales of recreational cannabis. But as the legal market has been slow to take off and has had trouble competing with the underground sale of cannabis, State Assemblyman Phil Ting has introduced a bill that would curtail local control. It would require cities and counties where at least half of the voters supported Proposition 64 that they would have to have at least one retail cannabis establishment. What do you think about that? Is that a bait and switch given what Prop 64 enacted in terms of local control? or is this a reasonable response to the challenges the legal market is having as it's been uncompetitive with the underground sale of cannabis? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. With us from the California Cannabis Industry Association, Communications Director Josh Drayton. Josh, thanks for joining us. Why do you think the environment has changed to the point where this bill is necessary?
Well, thanks for having me. Ultimately, you know, we are 18 months into the adult use market here in California. And what we've seen are cities and counties very slow to take the responsibility of creating local regulations. In California, we do have 538 jurisdictions, but of those, 393 voted in support of Prop 64. And at this point, what we're seeing are less than 25% of local municipalities with any regulations on the books whatsoever, whether they be adult use or medical. So I think this bill is a sign that the state is getting very frustrated that local municipalities have not moved forward with regulations and have not, really supported the will of their voters.
So under this, the formula would be that there'd be at least one legal cannabis license for retail sale for every six liquor licenses in the area, or the alternative, one legal retail cannabis establishment for every 15,000 residents. The lower number would prevail. And at least one of the licenses has to be medicinal. What's the rationale behind that formula?
Well, I think the formula has changed over time. The bill was recently amended this past Thursday in appropriations to reflect this number. So, I am not the author of the bill, and I'm not sure, why they came to this number specifically. But I would also highlight that local jurisdictions that do not want to meet this ratio can instead put a local ban on the ballot at the next scheduled election. You know, and this would ensure that the licensing policy accurately reflects the will of their community.
We're talking with Josh Drayton, California Cannabis Industry Association. Also with us from the California State Association of Counties, Legislative Representative Kara Martinson. Kara, thank you for being with us. Given that such a high percentage of cities have determined they will not allow retail recreational cannabis sales, what's wrong with the state stepping in and saying, if we want a robust industry, cities are going to have to capitulate?
Well, thank you, Larry, for having me. And I think my colleague Josh made a really good point. We are about 17, 18 months into an entirely new regulatory program. The state is regulating a new commodity for the first time and has set up a pretty complex regulatory structure to make sure it's done in a fair and accurate way. And that takes time. And I think the governor made this point in his press conference through the May revise that it's going to be, an evolution of 5 to potentially 7 years until we can really have a robust and dynamic marketplace in California. But what Prop 64 did was it allowed cities and counties to really determine what the will of their community was and to establish commercial programs that reflected that will. And that also takes time to do that public outreach, that communication with the residents to decide really what best suits the needs of that community. Because I do think there's a bit of a slight disconnect with folks and voters in California overwhelmingly supporting Prop 64 and saying we'd like the idea of legalization, but the conversation about where and how those businesses are regulated within a community is a much more intimate conversation that needs to happen at the city and the county level.
So your contention is, because the bill is sort of framed in such a way as that if you've got a city where the majority of voters supported Prop 64, the bill is taking that as an indication that they're willing to have retail cannabis within their city, but for whatever reason, the city council has decided they're not going to accept it. Sounds like you're contending just because the majority of voters supported Prop 64 in a city doesn't mean they necessarily wanted a retail cannabis establishment in their city.
I think that's a fair point, and it's a point I was trying to make, but I also think it's a timing issue. You know, cities and counties are dealing with a number of critical issues right now, including homelessness issues and a housing crisis and a number of other priorities where our resources are being focused. So if it is really the priority of the city or the county, I think those boards and those councils are listening and working with their residents to develop those programs. But again, we're about 17, 18 months into this process that's going to take some time and resources at the local level to develop really, you know, programs that respect that will of the community. And it just takes a little bit of time. And we don't think that this bill is really getting at the heart of that issue in particular.
We're talking with Kara Martinson of the California State Association of Counties, Josh Drayton of the California Cannabis Industry Association. What do you think about this bill, which would require that cities where the majority of voters supported Prop 64 have at least one retail cannabis establishment, and it is a formula for how many they would be required to permit based on the number of liquor licenses or the number of residents that the community has? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Astrogoth writes on the page, I live near Pico and Bundy in West L.A. There are three cannabis shops on every block of Pico in this area. In the last 6 months, I've noticed some turnover. A few shops have closed, others have changed names. Soon the pop bubble will burst, I think. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Rob asks on the page, aren't there delivery services available in these areas? I think local control of brick and mortar zoning is essential. That's Rob writing on the page. Josh Drayton, can't delivery services fill this gap where there's not brick and mortar sale?
Yeah, so delivery services are now available statewide. So that is something, again, that our licensing authorities always had that same understanding, similar to, you know, a pizza delivery. Even if your city or county does not have a pizza delivery, you could order from another county that does and have it brought in. So that is available. You know, we do believe that having retail establishments is also going to benefit the level of education for consumers. You know, one thing we haven't seen as of yet is, you know, a full education campaign to come from the state. The BCC's education campaign has just started, which will help consumers be able to identify regulated delivery services, retail establishments. It'll give them the skill set necessary to understand why it's important to support regulated businesses. But in Southern California, what we've also seen, you know, are a lot of illicit operators. They get shut down and then reopen, you know, within a couple blocks, like you were saying. So we really need more of a black and white picture moving forward of who's a legal operator and who's an unregulated operator.
All right. The BCC, by the way, is the State Bureau of Cannabis Control. Lori Ajax, who heads that bureau, a frequent guest with us on Air Talk as we take a look at marijuana policy throughout the state. Once again, my question for you is, if you live in a community where there are no permitted cannabis shops, would you like to see your city required to open, to permit cannabis shops to open if the majority of your fellow voters in the city voted for Proposition 64? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Share with us your thoughts about this, whether you think this would be a positive or a negative. Does this, in your view, is it a bait and switch to Prop 64, which explicitly allowed for local control, allowed cities or counties to choose not to permit retail establishments to sell? Does this defy the will of the voters? Or do you think it makes sense because maybe voters' points of view have changed in that there are so many communities that do not have legally permitted cannabis sales facilities? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Darin Irvine says, with alcohol, corner stores were able to sell it once prohibition ended. There weren't backlash from cities. Alcohol is more dangerous than weed. Now all of these cities are refusing to sell marijuana. Why? What's different? I don't like that cities are ignoring what the voters wanted. Dara, I understand the sentiment, but again, in Prop 64, it was explicitly spelled out that cities would be able to have that control. So at least for some voters, they were likely factoring that into their decision process. So Josh Drayton, why not put this in front of voters to let them decide instead of doing this through the state legislative process without the voters specifically choosing?
Well, actually, I think we're at the very beginning stages of seeing the frustration amongst the state legislature and the industry about cities and counties not taking their responsibility to regulate. I anticipate that in 2020, we could see initiatives and measures at many, many cities and counties throughout the state, if not a state initiative, to really streamline business practices. You know, I think the frustration that we're that we're feeling at this point is that local leaders commonly cite three main fears as to why they don't move forward on regulations, and that's crime, teen use increases, and property values decrease. And I'd like to highlight that Leafly just came out with a really great report. They looked at 42 studies done within all of the states that have legalized cannabis. They took that data and those numbers, and what they came up with was that crime rates are completely unaffected, that property values do increase with regulated dispensaries in neighborhoods, and in general, teen use declines. So I think moving forward, we need to be focusing on data and research and following the will of the voters.
Colton writes on the page, municipalities want to have their cake and eat it too. Well, you can't complain about the black market if you don't give the legal market a chance. Force local cities to respect the will of the voters and enjoy all this extra revenue already. That's Colton writing on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with John in Culver City. What do you think, John?
Well, I actually just kind of want to reiterate what that gentleman just wrote. The issue isn't whether or not you're going to allow it, because it's going to be sold regardless, right? That's the whole point, is there's a demand. So the real effort should be focused on quality controls, not whether or not they can sell it, because we've already spoken out about this, right? Like, there's a reason why there's a demand, and there's a reason why it got voted on. And that's my piece.
All right, John, appreciate it. Heather in Redlands, good to have you with us. What do you think?
Where I live, dispensaries are not allowed, and I have to travel via public transit quite a long ways to go to one. But I can't use delivery services because the minimum purchase amounts are too high. So low-income people who, you know, really aren't looking to buy a lot, who just need it occasionally, whatever, it's a real hardship. It's, you know, half my day is gone just trying to purchase it legally without spending so much money. And the other thing I want to add is that a lot of times the only way to confirm that something is a high quality, high regulated product, we have great regulations on marijuana in the state, but you can't, if you can't see the label, if you can't look at it in person, you don't always know that what you're getting is a well-regulated product.
So Heather, that's why you're willing to take public transit to a brick and mortar store to buy, as opposed to just buy it from someone who's selling underground in your area?
Well, there's no underground dispensaries in my area. There's only delivery. But again,
yeah.
I'm not physically...
I guess I meant through a friend. When I said underground, I meant like, you know, the way the people have historically bought cannabis.
I never did that. So
oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So, Heather, so how frequently do you take the bus to go make a purchase?
It's usually about twice a month. It's not a lot. But again, it's a hardship, and it's cheaper for me to take the bus to go to a dispensary to buy the amount I want than to order delivery where there's a minimum. And again, I'm not 100% sure about the quality. There's so many marijuana products that are not well regulated that are being sold by these dispensaries that actually contain a lot of harmful chemicals that can do more harm than good.
Heather, where do you go? What where's your closest dispensary you travel to?
Today I'm on the bus right now. I'm in hour one of a 3-hour journey to downtown Los Angeles.
You're going all the way downtown from Redlands to make your purchase.
Yes.
Wow. Heather, thanks for your call. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. At least you'll be mellow after you've taken that long bus ride to make your purchase. Katie in South Pasadena says, I live in an area without brick and mortar cannabis stores. I understand delivery is a solution, but as a woman, ordering alone at night feels rather risky. That's Katie in South Pasadena making the case for it. Eduardo in Santa Monica says, in Santa Monica, we don't have a dispensary. Residents voted here years ago, preventing people from arresting people with pot. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. My thanks to Kara Martinson, California State Association of Counties. They are lobbying against the bill introduced by Assemblymember Phil Ting, which would require municipalities where the majority of residents voted in favor of Prop 64 to have brick-and-mortar cannabis sales. Josh Drayton, the California Cannabis Industry Association, with us to speak in favor of the bill. Coming up on Air Talk, we'll discuss some of the weirdest or most highly focused trade magazines around, like Parking Lots Today. We'll hear about some of the strangest ones back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Coming up, we focus on some of the most surprising niche magazines you've ever seen. But I want to ask you, because we have so many different professions or interests that are represented in our AirTalk audience. Do you have a particular niche publication that you subscribe to or that you read regularly? Could be online, could be in print hard copy that you read it that way, but that is so targeted that when you share with your friends and family members that you read it, they just laugh. It's funny that there would be a magazine devoted to this interest or to this particular profession. I'd like to hear from you right now. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. With me is Diana Landau, a blog editor for Niche Media HQ, which puts on educational conferences for niche publishers, helping them learn how to monetize their publication and how to build readership. Diana, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get into this field?
Well, originally we had been publishing niche magazines like Brew Your Own for home brewers of beer, winemaker magazines, and we realized there wasn't a resource for publishers, especially the smaller niche publishers that are mom and pop, maybe second generation publishers. So we started these educational conferences so that we could bring publishers together and they can network with their peers, learn more ways to drive revenue and develop new products.
I'm looking on our AirTalk segment page. We have a cover of a recent edition of Potato Grower, serving the national potato industry, with a photo of a couple of guys, hoeing in the field. And then it says the human touch on the front of the magazine. I love it. Potato Grow. Another Twins, the celebrity hit list. Our interview with twins Peyton and Spencer, who are on the cover of the magazine for multiples since 1984. Now, there are a lot of twins, so that's potentially a large target audience. But how many twins are actually going to read Twin Magazine? 866, by the way, you get two copies of every issue, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Apparently, there's a magazine that some folks here at KPCC get called Meetings Today. All right. Meetings Today, meetings, convention, and conference industry news. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Diana, these conferences that your company puts on, do you have some people that come with niche publications that are just so off that you can't imagine them ever being successful?
I'd say for the most part, the ones that can afford to come to our conferences, they are doing well as a business. They've developed their business model, whether it's subscription-based or not, and they're business people, so that's why they're there. Sure, once in a while you'll get some people who have some original ideas that you think, huh, is that going to work? Or they want to spin off in some way. For example, you know, with you could start with agricultural news, and then it can go down to specific farm equipment and tractor magazine, and there's a pink tractor magazine just for women farmers. And then, of course, like you said, there's a potato magazine. There's magazines for corn crops. It just goes on and on and on.
866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. What very niche-oriented magazine do you subscribe to or regularly read that you think people would find surprising? 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Nicole writes on the page, I love finding little industry mags, Planet Laundry from the Coin Laundry Association, Automatic Merchandiser for the vending industry. And I caught a glimpse, Nicole writes, of Food Processor magazine at the butcher shop. For niche entertainment magazines, my favorite was Ukulele magazine. That's Nicole writing on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. EGW says, Nicole beat me to it. We've subscribed to dozens of trade magazines centered on easy startup industries, car wash industry, web design, amusement industry, specialty retail, staffing industry. Often free, they talk about current trends. They keep my mind sharp to know what each industry is doing. That's EGW writing on the Air Talk page. Astrogas says, I used to subscribe to one on arcade video games and pinball. I would drool all the things I could never afford. And also adds GEMS, J-E-M-S, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services, Paramedic Ventings, says on the page. 866-893-KPECC. Pippi writes on the page, Threads, devoted to sewing, a dying art. 866-893-KPECC. Diana, what are some of your favorites over the years?
Oh, one of my favorites is Crown Jewels of the Wire. I interviewed the publisher for this magazine. He's up in the Northwest. And it's for enthusiasts of the glass insulators that you find on electrical transformer poles. People collect them. They show them off in their gardens. And at one point, the economy was struggling, and so this publisher was struggling. And his readership was so passionate about these crown jewels of the wire that they sent him money to keep him going.
Doesn't that sound, that's so romantic? It's like Riders of the Purple Sage. It's got such a romantic sound to it. You just picture people scouring the landscape to find these. They're insulators, right, for the wires?
Right, right. They're little round glass insulators, and they come in different colors. Yes, and people are passionate about them, and that's really what niche magazines are about. People's passions, people's interests. I can think of one there's two, believe it or not, porta potty for portable restroom operators. They have over 20,000 subscribers.
Pro Magazine, Portable Restroom Operator Magazine, has more than 20,000 subscribers?
Between the two competing porta potty magazines, yes.
Two. That's a step. What would you even write about? Deodorizers, the frequency with which you pick up what's left behind at the site.
The latest innovation.
All right. 866-893-KPECC, the latest on dealing with vandalism of porta potties. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Let's see. There's River Islands Magazine. Wow. You talk about a niche there. That's for the true 1%, River Islands Magazine. Ira in Claremont, good to have you with us. What's one of your favorite of these highly specialty magazines?
Well, in the 60s, when I was married to my first wife, her father was a collector of antique barbed wire. He had frames of it in series of six samples, and there was a monthly collector's magazine about these things.
And it's just pictures of different types of barbed wire.
Yeah, and they talked about, you know, this wire was used between these years in this kind of a field, or, you know, I don't really remember the substance, just the fact of.
Ira, I appreciate it. The Barbed Wire Collector. Did you heard of that one, Diana?
I have not heard of that one, but I've heard of, there are so many random magazines out there that you just can't even imagine. Holistic Horse, it's been around for 20 years. It's not just about horses, it's about holistic care for horses. It's a big magazine. Modern Drunkard is a magazine for people who like to imbibe.
To excess, Modern Drunkard as opposed to Antique Drunkard. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. There's Fashion Doll Quarterly. Do you know that one, Diana?
Yes, I have heard of that one, and it's pretty interesting. It's high fashion wear for dolls that people create. There's even some advertisements within the magazine I've seen for doll lingerie, which we found pretty interesting.
866-893-KPECC. On the page, a field day is being had by Air Talk listeners with riffing off of this with imaginary trade magazine publications. That's fine, too. 866-893-KPECC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3. It's an opportunity for you to share the most offbeat, very highly focused, a niche magazine that is for a particular interest or field or trade. You can share it with us right now. We'll be back with more right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdies. I've been laughing through much of the break just reading the titles of some of these magazines. We're going to be talking about these highly focused specialty publications online or in hard copy print. You subscribe to one of these or just read it for your pleasure. Share the name or the subject matter at 866-893-KPECC. Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, Tia Powell, psychiatrist and bioethicist. Her new book is Dementia Reimagined, about the medical system and how it can improve in the ways it treats people with dementia, that in spite of the lack of medications to slow the progress of dementia. Terry with Tia Powell coming up in 20 minutes right here on KPECC. We're talking with Diana Landau, a blog editor for Niche Media HQ. They put on educational conferences for niche publishers to help them build revenue and readership. So we've got some more fun ones to share for you. Let's see. Josue in Granada Hills says, my parents subscribe to a religious newsletter about medallions and necklaces. The newsletter claims they're baptized with water from Jerusalem. Some of their friends wear them to church meetings and show them off. There also are apparently two competing publications, Emu Today and Emu Tomorrow magazine. Oh, it's the same magazine. Oh, I thought there were two separate ones. Someone started tomorrow so the emu farming wouldn't be locked in the past. 866-893-KPECC. Jennifer in downtown Los Angeles, what's your favorite niche publication?
Yes, good morning. I so enjoy a magazine I subscribe to called Garden and Gun. And I am not the demographic this magazine is aimed at. It's when you look at it, you very clearly instantly get the impression it's aimed at very, very wealthy Southerners. It covers very extensive, elaborate gardens in the South and gardening tips, hunting tips for pheasant and quail and such, and the best birding dogs out there, antique collecting and Southern recipes. And I just love this magazine.
I understand the hunting focus and I understand the garden focus, but why? What's the through line between the two in the magazine?
Right, right. I'm not quite clear on that, but somehow it works.
Right.
It's a, it's a beautiful magazine. The photographs are stunning. They clearly have a very large budget for this magazine, and it's just a pleasure to look at.
So it's aimed at well-to-do Southerners.
Very well-to-do Southerners. There's always advertisements for yachts and your next vacation to the Caribbean and purchasing a summer home somewhere in the South and so on and so forth.
Wow. All right, Jennifer. So it's a window into a subculture. 866-893-KPECC. Elizabeth tweets at AirTalk, the American Bee Journal, first published in 1861 and published continuously since. Obviously not aimed at bees, but presumably beekeepers and those who love them. 866-893-KPECC. Tiffany in Culver City, what niche publication finds its way into your home?
Well, there's a magazine called Clowning Around, which we were automatically subscribed to when my husband purchased performance insurance through the World Clown Association.
Your husband's a clown?
No, he's a magician, actually.
Okay.
But they decided to grace us with this very startling magazine that comes about every 3 or 4 months in the mailbox.
So there's a scary clown on the cover of each Clowning Around magazine?
In my opinion, they're terrifying.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it, Tiffany. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Diana Landau, Clowning Around, is that one that's come to your attention?
I have heard of that one before. And going back to what your caller said about Garden and Gun, that is a very successful magazine. And surprisingly, probably because it's such a well-done magazine, they have subscribers all over the country.
All right.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Onion World, Onion Industry News is another one of these publications. Judd in Valley Village, what's one of your favorite highly targeted publications?
All right. Well, it's not as weird as onions or clowns, but I was a kid starting out my career. I was on my very first business trip. I was 21 years old, and I'm on the plane. And I think I've got a pretty wide view of the world. And I look down and I see somebody's reading Roofers Weekly. And I know roofing is not very strange, but it caught my eye and I realized, wow, this is a very wide world with a lot of people who care about a lot of very specific things. And it kind of just changed the way I looked at the world from that moment on. I thought, if there's Roofers Weekly, you know, God knows what else there is out there. And it just changed my perspective of the sort of the entire world.
Yeah, Drywall Monthly. Judd, I appreciate it. How could there be that much in roofing to fill a publication regularly? I guess there are enough different types of materials. Could include, you know, the latest solar technology. I don't know if there's differences in installation techniques, but that's the thing, Diana, with so many of these, you wouldn't think there'd be enough content to fill a publication.
You would think that initially, but as you dive into them, you can see that there's always there's a section about the history of whatever it is. Like, for example, I was just in a doctor's office, and there was War Monthly, all about wars we've had throughout the ages. And there was a historical component. There was about the people involved. There was about the ammunition involved. There was about the countries involved. I mean, if you take any subject and you just start drilling down, it's actually kind of fun. I mean, you can think of all the different ways that you can reach that audience.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. And of course, there is a Talkers magazine, you should know. Michael Harrison, the publisher of it, has been a frequent guest with it. And it's aimed at talk show hosts or people that listen to talk shows. So there's another example of a very niche publication, 866-893-KPECC. Let's see. We have next Liam in Palm Desert. Thanks for being with us, Liam. So what niche publications interest you?
Well, I'm an organist, so there's American Guild of Organists magazine. They have organs that go in concert halls and churches and installations and pictures of their organs that go in. And then they have the concert organists and their advertisements. And then they have advertising for job openings all over the country. And then there's a smaller niche magazine for American theater organ and the likes, but that's a smaller one. But
yeah, I'm not surprised because I've known enough people who are deeply interested in organs. I'm not surprised that there's such an enthusiastic group, because if you're really interested in organs, you've got so many historic instruments and uniqueness of each of them. There's a lot there, and they're a passionate group. Liam, I'm sure you can attest. Thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC. Ariel sends me a copy from a few years ago, the 20th anniversary special issue of Divorce Magazine. That's right, Divorce Magazine. So I don't know whether this highlights like some of the most contentious divorces, gives you advice on surviving divorces or tactics that you should use. 866-893-KPECC. Bruce in Baldwin Park, what's your favorite specialty magazine?
There are actually two of them that I have subscribed to. One is called Bourbon, and it's all about bourbon, and it's a glorious, well-shot, well-put-together magazine. And the other one is Chili's for hot peppers. They're the two magazines I subscribe to that are my friends find around my house and think I'm strange.
Now, do you work in the food industry, or you're just an enthusiast?
I'm an enthusiast. I am seriously a bourbon head, and I also like a chili head. So there are two magazines that fit into my hobby.
All right. I appreciate it, Bruce. Thanks. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue here from Stefan in downtown Los Angeles, who's got a couple to contribute, Daniel in Whittier, and Chris in Long Beach. We're talking about niche magazines that you might not be aware of, from Elevator World to Potato Review. 866-893-KPECC. Back after this one-minute message. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Highly specialized publications are focused. Alvin in Southlake Tahoe says he once saw a magazine called Western Mule at his doctor's office. He couldn't believe it and had to take a picture. Lynn writes on the Air Talk page, says, I probably get magazines about the radio industry. Indeed, I do. I just mentioned Talkers, wondering about Inside Microphones. No, I don't know that publication, but if I did, I would read it. I'm sure I'd actually have that one on my coffee table at home, with beautiful old microphones, and that would give people pause, I'm sure, when they look at the microphone fetish. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Stefan, in downtown Los Angeles, your favorite niche publications.
Hi, Larry. I come from a little bit of a different perspective. I actually serve magazines. We provide services for them. So I've got a couple hundred, so I can provide you a few names that I think are kind of niche-y. It's Windows Fashion Magazine. It's all about, accents you can put on windows.
Yeah.
Cake decorating. And also with another magazine called Urban Bagger, which is about, the motorcycle lifestyle and the bags that you have on the back of your motorcycle.
Are you serious? There's a magazine just for that aspect of being a biker. amazing.
It's about the bags you put on, the lifestyle, that the traveling you do with that.
Wow. So, Stefan, you provide subscription services. So do you just contract with anybody who wants to have you process subscriptions, or are there some you give advice that, you know, you're dubious about the premise of the publication?
I would never go so far as to give advice on the premise of the publication. It's surprising, you know, the different interests that people have and the devoted following that many of these magazines have. You know, we can see the orders coming in. We can see, you know, the money coming in. You know, there's so many different varied interests. It's really incredible.
All right, Stefan, thanks. I appreciate it very much. Margaret and Yorba Linda, I'm getting a preview of what you're calling. You've got to be putting me on with this one.
Oh no! It's out there. Colored pencil artist.
Colored pencil artist. And what's in the publication?
Well, there's competitions for people that are professional, and it's quite a large group of people out there who are doing professional art with colored pencil. And there's discussions of the different kinds of pencils and what's new, what's not new. There's discussions of the competitions that are coming in, pictures of people and what they're doing and how they're rendering their art.
All right. Well, see, now it makes sense. I judged too soon. Margaret, I appreciate it. Colored Pencil Artist, 866-893-KPCC. Let's see. We have... another one. Oh, Walter in Cypress Park in L.A. says, one of my favorites is Monument Maker News for people who inscribe headstones for graveyards. I used to live next to an abandoned storefront where a company who did this used to be. And when I walked in, they had stacks and stacks of Monument Maker News. I was fascinated. That's Walter in Cypress Park. You ever heard of that one, Diana Landau?
I have not heard of that one, but I can tell you there's a magazine called Roller Coaster for American coaster enthusiasts around the country.
Yeah, I can see that because that's a real thing. Now, I have to ask you about this, and I don't mean to be distasteful. There are all sorts of particular fetishes people are into. Do you deal with any of these folks at your conference that are in the sexual domain?
No, we don't.
You specifically avoid those things. All right. They probably have their own conference.
They probably do.
I would guess. All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Daniel in Whittier, your favorite niche publication.
Yeah, so I accidentally ran into a magazine called Hobby Japan, and it's this beautiful Japanese publication with gorgeous pictures of miniature models, you know, anything from like World War II era tanks and planes to like fantasy robots to like anime characters. And really, as a result of seeing this magazine, I bought a few more, and I actually had no experience with building models, but it got me into buying a few here and there. And now, you know, it's kind of a big hobby for me, but there's such a huge following here. But it's on another level in Japan with like companies like Bandai, and it just shows all the beautiful things that you can make, and just the painting and the detail in it. It's really amazing.
I'm fascinated, Daniel, that this got you into actually constructing models. And where did you come across the magazine if you weren't already interested in this?
So I was at a comic book store, and they had a box full of old magazines. And this magazine was dated 1996, and this magazine's still going on. And I was just like, my gosh, like a lot of the characters I'm into, like they have these gorgeous models you can really build from tiny little pieces. And you can kind of look at the work and you're like, wow, that's something I'm already into, but I had a hand in like building this thing. And I'm so clumsy that it's really therapeutic for me to be able to complete a model. And it's really just against my nature because I'm not artistic at all.
All right.
It's really cool.
Hey, Daniel, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Bill in Buena Park, you've got a couple of publications to highlight.
Yes, I do. I used to work in a small print shop in Orange County, and I used to print a couple of publications. So I would read them as I'm printing them and stuff. And one of them was for Packard Auto Collectors. It was for Packard International. classic cars. And then another one was for carousel, the whole carousels and the art of the horses and stuff and restoring them and about famous carousels all over the country. And I remember one particular story that was supposed to be a haunted carousel up in a amusement park up in Northern California somewhere, that people tried to take photos of this one horse and they'd always come out blurry no matter how the lighting was.
Ooh.
The story was someone was to meet at this carousel and the person died or something.
Haunted carousel horse. Bill, thanks. Nicholas in Placentia says he's been in the pizza business for 17 years and part of a franchise for 26. Says everybody in his business reads Pizza Today, which their subscriber base must have exploded with how pizza has risen in popularity. That's got to be one that'd be a very good business to be in, to be the publisher of Pizza Today. Chris in Long Beach says, I'm always intrigued when I go back home. My mother-in-law in Louisville, Kentucky, has a magazine called Yesteryear, about things that used to be around but aren't anymore. Basically, Chris says, bunch of junk people don't know, how to get rid of that's in the publication. And Brian in Arcadia says, the Journal of Roofers and Waterproovers. In college, I shelved periodicals, made fun of that one. Never thought anyone would read it. I learned over the years, every trade has a magazine. Well, that's, of course, how they survive. Ben in La Crescenta says, Breaking the Habit, a magazine for those who are battling addiction. All right. Diana Landau of Niche Media HQ, which puts on conferences for niche publishers, thank you so much for being with us and talking about such an incredible array of niche publications. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up next from all of us at AirTalk. Have a terrific afternoon.